Inner Voice, a heartfelt chat with Dr. Fujian.
Hello, everyone. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain. This is the Inner Voice Show. Hello to Sean in studio and a big hello to all of you. An exciting show today. I'll bring you Dr. Andrea Pennington, an integrative medicine doctor, a TEDx speaker. And today, we'll be talking about her latest book, which is The Accumulation of Real Life Love Stories of Conscious Relationships Co-Created with the Universe, Manifesting Love. Then I'll bring you Eileen McDar. She's the Chief Energy Officer at the Resiliency Group, as well as a consultant to major national and international organizations. We will be talking about her new book, Burnout or Breakthrough, Building Resilience to Refuel, Recharge, and Reclaim What Matters. And I wanted to share also something with you, which is the Holiday Road, a drive-through amazing holiday experience, the only one in town, and you're going to be driving through, so it's safe, at the King Gillette Ranch in Calabasas, California. It's open now till January 10th. Purchase your ticket at holidayroadusa.com, holidayroadusa.com. First, I want to give you the tip of the week. So this week, I've been observing the difference between how people go from anxiety-producing thoughts to calming thought processes. How I've distinguished this matter is that we live in different tenses, right? We can live in the past or the future and the present tense. We also split up the tenses into positives and negative senses. So when we concentrate on the negative past events, relive them constantly, generalize the decision that we made from the past, and with that, we tend to create an overall decisions that end up projecting into the future. When we want to plan our future as a protective measures, we tend to rely on our negative past to learn from our mistakes and be watchful to protect ourselves from the future harm. There's also a high cost in that. We tend to put fear as the source of moving toward the future, which holds us back from moving forward. Now, concentrating on our positive past allows us to take our skills and resilience into consideration and have a fact-based set of strengths and skills to carry us, and that gives us confidence toward building a positive and a reality-based future. Focusing on the negative past creates sorrow, helplessness, powerlessness, ultimately depression. Focusing on the positive past creates a sense of gratitude and fulfillment. Focusing on the negative future, guess what? Produces anxiety. We create a horror show for ourselves about a future that we already assume powerless toward. Focusing on the positive future requires faith, not in the sense of the religious faith, although for some that works, but what I mean by faith into trusting based on our own positive past, others' positive outcomes, and our own skills and strength, that we will create a future that is planned based on reality. Since we're set up to live in all the tenses in our imagination and only be able to act from one tense, which is the present moment, it's important to be aware and rely on our sense of confidence toward our abilities to make the right decisions for ourselves. So have faith. Have faith in yourself and your capabilities, your strengths, and your wisdom. We will be right back with Dr. Andrea Pennington. Everyone, guess who I have again? I love her. I keep asking her to come over and share with you all the nice stuff and great stuff that she has. She's busy. She's really busy. She's popping out constantly. Yes, I'm talking about my dear Dr. Andrea Pennington. She's an integrative medicine doctor, acupuncturist, a TEDx speaker, and an author of several books, including I Love You, Me. And actually, we had a conversation about that book.
We did.
Orgasm Prescription for Women. You all need it. She specializes in self-love, mindfulness, and authentic self-expression. She has also compiled or co-authored 7 books. And today, we will be talking about her latest book, which is The Accumulation of Real Life Love Stories of Conscious Relationships Co-Created with the Universe. And the name is Manifesting Love. Welcome to the show again.
Thank you, Fujian. It's such a pleasure, as always, to connect with you.
So, I love this book. It's an accumulation of a lot of great aspects. It's almost like I'm beginning to write a relationship from my model, from the awareness integration model for the couples. And as I was going through this, it's like, yes, those are exactly the topics that we got about. So everyone, manifesting love as amazing, systematic. It goes through everything that you need to know in order to manifest that. So you first start with relationship history and how much important it is for us to look at our own history and the way that we have been and what areas that we need to look at. So can you share a bit about that with us?
Yes. Well, what we see in this book, for example, is we see a range of people from their 30s up. Well, we won't go all the way up. But what we see is that some people have been married and divorced a few times over. Some people were just finding love for the very first time. But what is kind of this common theme was being able to look back on their history and relationships to notice certain patterns. So, for example, Abby Kelly, she found herself in situationships, not even relationships. In her mind, she thought they were real. But when she started to look at the pattern of how these F-boys, as she calls them, as how they were treating her, she finally had this wake-up call. Now, unfortunately, in her case, it took a diagnosis of cancer for her to realize that these guys were not showing up for her the way that she wanted to be. And so by looking at your relationship history, you know, sometimes we want to point the finger at, oh, well, this person did that, that person did that. And we're always pointing the finger outside of ourselves. But the reality is, if you keep having a string of bad relationships, the one constant might be you. And it might be that you're, I've been guilty. I mean, believe me, I have been processing, like, why do I get in certain relationships? Why do I say yes? Why do I give more? Why do I let go of my boundaries? Some people were asking, well, why is it that I attract these men, for example, who are not reflecting back the same level of value that I have for myself? And so by doing a relationship history, you become really conscious and aware of what you're bringing to the table, what you've allowed, that maybe you're finally ready to say no more. I'm not going to allow myself to go down these roads again. Because you, as a therapist, you know this, you know how our childhood affects us, especially in our romantic relationships. Whether you had a perfect childhood and now, let's say you're a female heterosexual and now you want this perfect man, just like your perfect dad, or you grew up in a situation where there was abuse and neglect, and not consciously, but subconsciously, you are attracting and attracted to these kind of people who will repeat those patterns. So we have to become conscious of it when we decide that we really want to manifest love. So that's why we start with the relationship history.
It is so important. Yes, the way that I had looked at my own history as I was reading your book too, it's more of, I connected with people who had somehow either a trauma or some sort of a depression. And and my mother was very much like a, kind of like a narcissist. So it was more like natural to move toward the same type. And then I was chosen, not that I chose, but I was chosen for that. So it was very interesting to look at the environment and the way that I would, out of 10 people who would be maybe a candidate for me to create a relationship, that I will go after those pieces. And it didn't even show up at the beginning. Like, you don't even see it. And then you're like, was it somehow? Because it shows up afterward. And then you go into the most important factor, which we see from the attachment theories about how the attachment style, and when we're aware of that, the same thing, which mine was like a avoidant and type of an anxiety driven type of an attachment. And when I experience that type of anxiety out of that avoidance, I call that love. That was like, I must be in love. It wasn't the essence of love. It was that I had superseded that name. So I love that you have added that chapter into this wonderful book. Can you talk a little bit about it?
Yes, I had to do it for myself. Because again, looking at my relationship history, it was like, why do I keep... So you'll see people with a few different themes. So you've brought up the avoidant pattern. And some of our authors had said that they recognized that they were always with these emotionally unavailable guys, or they were just getting kind of crumbs. They were just given being fed just enough to kind of stay on the hook. But when they really needed someone to show up for them, if they were with this avoidant or dismissive, they were just left high and dry. And so it's really important if you happen to have a secure attachment style, meaning most probably in childhood, your needs were tended to. That's food and attention and comfort and love, so that you had a secure attachment with your caregivers. Unless you had something else terrible that happened, you are more likely going to have a secure attachment style as an adult. And for secures, we can sometimes tolerate if someone is a little clingy or if someone is a little bit aloof, because we don't anticipate that they're going to leave us or they're rejecting us or that it's not personal. But if you happen to be someone who grew up, you know, with any sort of attachment, you know, challenges. So in my case, I'll just keep it real here. My parents got divorced when I was 3, as you may remember. And my father and my mother moved separately in 2 different states. And at this time, we didn't have Skype. We didn't have FaceTime. So I only saw my dad, you know, once or twice a year, and the rest of it was on the telephone. And so if you can imagine a baby who was held every day by my dad while my mom was away at the hospital, they were doing shifts. I was always in his arms, and people used to say he used to sing to me and read to me. So can you imagine at age 3, it was abrupt change of household, then change of state. So I know that I grew up with this sense of like this longing. And I was, you know, quite often in a long distance relationship, kind of like that. But it took me to kind of recognize that sometimes as soon as there was like closeness or intimacy in relationships when I was much younger, I would kind of freak out because I wasn't used to it. And I'd run in the opposite direction. So I had a little bit of this ambivalent and sometimes dismissive. But I've had these other friends and clients who had a very clingy attachment style, that every time there was even just a funny look on someone's face, they would be like, do you not love me anymore? Do you not want me anymore? And so we have to recognize those in ourselves so that we can first help ourselves, because you don't have to be plagued by, you know, always feeling like you're too much for someone or not enough. And if you are not yet feeling that security, you may not want to be with an avoidant or dismissive. You might want to make sure that you are going for the secure attached person. So we've only given just an overview of that in the book, Manifesting Love. But I do think it's really important for people, especially if you've had a series of bad relationships or failed relationships where you're like, okay, what am I missing here?
Absolutely. Then it was the section that we talked about giving and receiving love. And I know that people have such a different way of expressing their love, or the way that they allow themselves to receive it, whether it is an allowance they think that they have the right to, they're entitled to it, or they don't deserve it, or they do deserve it. And then even if they do think that they deserve it, then, you know, they sometimes get caught up with the style that it's being given to them. Or they get caught in very restricted in the style that they will only be giving and not necessarily expand themselves in experiencing different versions of how they can give themselves and their love. Can you share a bit about that, please?
Yes. Again, this is just an overview, but when I first read Gary Chapman's book, The 5 Love Languages, my mind was like, oh, that's why so-and-so... And basically what his research came up with is these 5 different styles of giving and receiving love. And so I may be someone who likes to tell you how beautiful you are and how much I love you and how much I appreciate you. Those are words of affirmation. But if you're someone who really values physical touch, all that talk may not actually sink into your heart as a feeling of, oh, this person loves me. And for me, my number one love language is quality time. I want like eye to eye contact, no phones, no other stuff going on. But I've been in relationships where that wasn't the same thing for them. And when you have that mismatch, even though your partner may truly love you and they're doing other things, maybe they're buying you little gifts, maybe they tidy up the house or they always take out the trash because they know you don't like mess. That's an act of service. But if you're not receiving the kind of love language that meets your needs, you may feel this disconnect. So I highly recommend that people be aware of that as well, because you can always ask your partner. You can say, hey, hon, to be honest, quality time is my number one way that I can feel that you really care for me and that you're present for me. So even though I love all the little gifts, can we just like hang out, you know, turn on some music, sit on the couch, or go for a walk in nature where we can really be present with each other? And that's really critical because, again, if you want to manifest the love of your life, you need to think through like, what would make me feel loved and what am I willing to do to demonstrate that love to my beloved?
So the book is set up almost to, for you as a reader to become aware of what's going on first and then clean up and then manifest. Because if you don't do this, the manifestation is all convoluted. So another part of the cleanup that shows up in your book is to become aware and look at the unhealed wounds, whether they're unspoken expectations or mismatched attachment style or things that are happening where unfinished business in any format that you have, or belief systems that are not working anymore, but they're definitely running the show. So to be able to really become aware of that. So share a little bit about that.
Yeah. So you've kind of summed it up, but if we aren't aware of what's driving us, we can end up getting into these unconscious patterns. And so many of the authors, a very clear theme to several of the stories in Manifesting Love is about self-love. So being able to recognize, wow, I'm getting into these relationships because I'm trying to get validation and approval instead of just loving myself. So like in the case of Leanne Wine and Abby Kelly, they both went on these journeys of self-love. And so did Margareta Tosi, where dating themselves, going on trips, you know, flying to different countries by themselves, just to get comfortable with this act of self-love and to kind of heal those wounds where they were previously looking elsewhere. So those are kind of a big deal. One of the other authors, Lena Nielsen from Denmark, she had experienced a divorce and she was alone caring for her son. And she realized, wow, I'm so sad. But she had realized that she was not even fully present for her son because of her sadness. And with her ex-husband being far away, she realized that's like a double whammy for her son. Dad's far away. And even though she was present in the house, she needed to do that cleanup that you're talking about. And in her case, she went on a self-love journey that included a personal development course and feng shui. So she was literally cleaning up the space in her home because someone said to her, like, you can't expect that someone is going to want to come and live in this house when it still has the vibe of your ex. So through feng shui and through, you know, really getting in touch with what does she like, what lights her up, it transformed the energy and ultimately allowed her to attract and manifest her partner.
Beautiful. Let's talk about manifesting. Mm-hmm. What does it take to manifest? We talked about how to become aware of yourself, of your history, of your patterns, of the unfinished businesses, and how to heal yourself. After you get all of that, you become aware of the attachment style you've had. And then, you know, how can you heal those parts of you that you needed? And then you're ready for manifestation. So what does it take to manifest the vision of a relationship that you have? So one of the things that shows up for me is, first, you got to get that part of the vision that you have, it could be still attached to the wounds. So it's healing those and becoming aware, then it'll create a new vision for you, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That vision, for me, it's a big part of any sort of manifestation, whether that's a career or a house or stuff or the love of your life. That step, the first thing I believe you really need is an openness. But an openness like that's coming from a place of fullness rather than lack. So you're not coming at this trying to get someone who's going to make you whole, because you're already whole. And if you feel like there's still something missing, then there's some healing work to be done. Because there are two stories in this book, actually. I mean, this is about manifesting love. But Karina Virginia, who you know, our dear friend, who was with us at Peace Village, and Ofkia Tekens from the Netherlands, they both were resisting, pushing away their soulmate until they got to this point of a true opening. And then what's needed next is that vision. And once each of them started to get this idea of, well, what would I really want? How would it be to wake up next to my beloved? What would be the things that we would do? What are our likes and dislikes? How do we solve conflicts? Do we travel a lot? Do we not travel? So having a really clear relationship vision is so important when you want to manifest, because you want to attract someone who's going to be into that. And in the case of Margareta, she, after healing anger and doing the self-love journey, she just got to this openness of heart where it was like, okay, I'm ready. And she is the one person in the book who really did an elaborate ritual. She lit candles, she put on makeup, she put on this beautiful dress, she had music, and she set the scene to say, universe, I am ready to manifest love. And she wrote down the qualities that she wanted her beloved to have, and the things that he would be like and do and all of these things. And then she lit it and released that energy to the universe and said, okay, it's up to you. And that within the months, she ended up meeting her beautiful Daniele. And they've been married now for 7 years. They have a child. They are just a beautiful couple. So it's part ritual, but it's part that openness and that readiness. And the last thing I'll say is there are two other stories, Karen Joy Almond and Eric Gerson. Now they each were in the state of Maryland going through their own sort of manifestation process. Eric's has a very visual kind of intentional speaking out to the universe. And he was like walking around his property out in the yard with his dogs. And he was like, okay, she's going to have to love dogs because he's got big dogs. And he was going through this stuff, and this face flashed into his consciousness. He'd never seen this face before, didn't recognize it, but he was like, okay. Karen, on the other hand, was being very detailed about what she wanted and was on a dating site and decided that she was going to put something out there. Well, when they first matched, she was kind of like, no. I wanted this, and I said I wanted this, 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 and this. But sometimes the universe really does know what we need. Like, so in their case, what they had to do is also surrender. So just like I said, Margareta, she went through this detailed ritual and then she surrendered. I think that is another critical part of being able to manifest, because we in our egoic mind, we think we know exactly what we want, but sometimes the universe knows a little bit better and can draw those souls to us that we need.
I actually had a dream, which didn't have the person's face, but it did have their name, almost 10 years before.
Really?
I met my husband, 10 years before I met my husband, and it was in a dream. And I also saw in the dream Amalfi Coast, that we were in Amalfi Coast. And then I remember, and I didn't even realize this until we actually did go to Amalfi Coast. And then suddenly, you know, you come up from the hill and then this whole scenery shows up. And I just started like bawling. And he's like, what happened? I'm like, this was my dream. And your name was in that dream. Oh my God. And it was like 10 years before. You're right. The universe has its own weird stuff to do.
Wow.
Andrea, if you... in 1 minute, if there's anything we need to say which we haven't yet covered, what is it you want everybody to know about you in this book?
I would say don't give up. Mm-hmm. Even if you've been trying dating apps and this, that, and the other thing, I truly believe that if your heart is really ready for love, that with the nearly 8 billion people on the planet, there is a match for you. So I would just say also a shout out to our friends at Our Love, who have created a soul connection app which is a completely different sort of dating app. You can check out the link on my website if you need it. But don't give up. There's someone for you.
Beautiful. Where can they go to find, well, they can go to AndreaPennington.com, but also where do they find the Manifesting Love?
ManifestingLoveBook.com.
ManifestingLoveBook.com. Everyone, Manifesting Love, the accumulation of real life love stories of conscious relationships co-created with the universe. Thank you so much, Dr. Andrea Pennington.
Thank you, Pooja.
Again. And I'm looking forward to your next, creation with you. Take good care and don't go anywhere, everyone. We'll be right back. Well, welcome back, everyone, again. I'm Dr. Fujian Zain, and I'm so excited to have Eileen McDermott with us. She is the Chief Energy Officer. Yes, the CEO, Chief Energy Officer at the Resiliency Group, where she draws on practical business know-how, life experience, and years of consulting with major national and international organizations, including global pharmaceuticals, the U.S. Armed Forces, healthcare associations, and religious institutions. We're going to talk about her new book, which I need, and I'm sure you guys do, Burnout to Breakthrough, Building Resilience to Refuel, Recharge, and Reclaim What Matters. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here.
One thing that was interesting, I thought it was personal, but then right at the beginning of your book, you're like, you know, burnout is a global pandemic recently, and it's everywhere. And it's interesting that even when, you know, the past 10 months, which we've been in the other pandemic, and I've talked with people, some of them are like, oh my God, we're working more than we were before. And then I talked to many of, like, you know, my own gurus in the psychology world, and, you know, I'm a psychotherapist. So I work with some of these people and they're all like in their 70s and 80s. And they're like, I've never worked so hard, even when I was in my 20s. And it's like, what's going on with everybody? So tell us, how come it's become a pandemic?
Well, first off, it was the World Health Organization called it a pandemic. Well, they didn't call it a pandemic. They called it a global occupational hazard in May of 2019. So people were already working, you know, overtime, and not just overtime, but let me define burnout, because I think it's really important. And this is the term that was created by Dr. Herbert Freudenberger in the 70s. And it is to exhaust one's resources, striving to reach some unrealistic expectation imposed upon by yourself or society. And it is this notion of exhaustion. And with that exhaustion is everything else that comes with it. You know, disenchantment, you can't sleep, overdoing or underdoing it. There's a whole number of things. So this has been around for a long time, I think, and we can talk about this later, some of the triggers, some of the prompts that today's environment, and when I say today, I'm not even talking about COVID yet, but in May 19, it's just incredible. We don't stop. And now the book came out, the final manuscript was due December of 2019. Well, what happened 2 months later? COVID-19. And now we're seeing, the good news is it's time for my book. The bad news is it's time for this book.
That's true. But thank God for the book, because it brings us, it does a knock, knock, like, hello, knock, knock.
That's really good.
You talk about 5 triggers that might contribute to our burnout.
Right.
You talk about personal history and voices, and it meant a lot when I read that, because it really shows. For example, my mother was someone that I remember, you know, used to work a lot, and she was one of the first and, let's say, high place in, she had a radio and a television show, and she was working constantly with shows and different things. And I remember I had to go to school, I had to come back, and I had to go to two schools, and I had to learn three languages, and I had to do all of these things. So from childhood, her mentality was that if I was going to be everything she did, plus all the things that she didn't do, so I had to do that. And it was more like I had to wake up 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning and go all the way to 10 p.m. And guess what? I'm 59, and that's exactly what I still do. It's more like a programming that was created, and that history follows me. The voices that are there, that you got to go, you got to get bigger, you got to do bigger, you got to, you know, influence more people. And my God, that by itself is exhausting.
Exactly. So let me ask you a question. Why are you listening to those voices?
I think that it's become an identity, and it's almost like, and I've noticed this, Eileen, which is I go into this concept of I've got to stop. And then one day where I don't have anything to do, I'm like, I'm going to rest. And then I meditate and I'm resting. And right, Eileen, when I'm meditating and resting, I come up with five new innovative ideas. And I'm like, excuse me, I think you were supposed to get back and rest. So that's the dilemma. Mm-hmm. With the voices that are there that have been programming where you gotta go, you gotta go, you gotta go.
And what happens to you when you listen to those voices? What's your body telling you?
I love this therapy session, by the way. My body says, you must be kidding. I cannot handle one more. That every part of my body aches. And then my emotions are elated about doing something new. It's like, ooh. And then when I say no, then I, you know, it's like this child is a pouts, like, what? I can't go have fun anymore. So it's all of these things where, you know, it sneaks right in, and I find myself committing to this whole new project without even completing the last one. Mm-hmm. And then my body will have pain, and we'll probably, you know, at one point is like, no, we're not doing this anymore. So you're laying flat. You can't move for about a day.
And do you choose to do that?
It appears that a part of me is choosing, but many other, my body is choosing out.
And what would be the wisest part? First off, this is the engine that drives the locomotive. You don't take care of this, you can't do five exciting projects.
Thank you.
Well, am I right?
Absolutely.
What we do is we do them half-ass. You know, we don't do them. So what would happen if, and you don't have to answer this, if you looked at what is the thing that I would get the greatest joy of right now for this new week that we're starting? What one or two things would give me great joy and I would feel that I had done a good job? What are those one or two things?
Let me think about it.
Actually, you don't have to answer, but seriously, and we all, for particularly for female entrepreneurs, we're driven. You know, because you were lucky to have a mom who did all of these things and go, oh my God, I got to be as good as my mom. But what I think it influences us and puts additional pressure on us is technology.
Yes.
Because now we have all this access. So, oh my gosh, I've got this email coming over here and somebody's texting me over here and I got this story idea over here, and we are bombarded all of the time. And so one of my first thoughts is, how do you craft what Cal Newport, who is he's a computer scientist, a professor at Georgetown, calls deep focus. What if you pushed away all of these other things and said, what is the one or two things that I want to focus on, which means my cell phone is off and away, put it in the refrigerator so I can't even hear it. Actually, the refrigerator is not a bad place to put it. Put it in the refrigerator. Don't take any calls. What is it that at the end of that time, whether it's an hour or two, I could say to myself, wow, that was a good job. And now I can move on to something else. Because until we stifle those voices in our head, and you know this as a therapist, you're on that hamster wheel, hamster wheel, hamster wheel, and you and only you can decide to get off until or unless your body just falls over and says, that's it, can't do it.
You talk about technology and the way that, you know, all of the social media and everything is buzzing. And the next one you talk about is also being disconnected, that yes, we are so involved in ourselves and in the technology and everything else that we're not also gaining energy from each other because we're so disconnected from each other.
Yeah. In fact, it's Mithik Murthy, who I understand actually might be named again to be our Surgeon General here for the United States. He was the Surgeon General under Bill Clinton. He wrote a wonderful book called Together. And what he's saying is that loneliness, feeling alienated, is as dangerous as smoking 15 cigarettes a day. And one of the things that when he would bring his team together, and I don't know whether they met once a week or twice a week, they would go around and people took turns. So this Monday, it's yours. And you were to share 5 minutes of something about yourself that nobody would ever know, whether it was skill you had as a kid or a game you like to play or the movie you just saw. The whole point of it was to allow people to see each other as more than title, as more than a job description. Well, now that we are in this COVID thing, I think one of the challenges for all of us is to, and I love it, that the camera's on. This isn't just a podcast. You and I get to look at each other. You are looking in my office. I'm looking at this beautiful blue background that you have and this gorgeous outfit. And I'm looking at your face and you're smiling. What we're doing is the opposite of the words that we're using. The words we're using are social distancing. No. Physical distancing, yes. Social connection, we crave. We want that. So in this COVID world, how do I create the social connections? If I'm bringing together some people, if I'm managing someone, and maybe I've got five of them, what do? We start out to check in with each other. How are you doing? What's the thing that's making you smile today? What's the thing that's making you cry? Because you know what? It gives us even more than what we had when we were in our individual offices, that we didn't see each other, that we sent an email down the hall instead of walking out and talking to each other. So we actually have, it's what I call intelligent optimism. It's the way of reframing what at face value, and it is terrible, but it's saying, is there a way that I can look at this that says, okay, what's the positive side of this? And the positive side is we can develop some better, deeper relationships than we can when we were in the very, traditional, sterilized office building or roles or whatever.
You also talk about roles of organizations in creating a space, let's say, for burnout. Not necessarily for it to create burnout, but to also create the space for burnout. What do you, can you share a little bit about that?
Well, first off, I think that we should be allowed to use the word. We need to name things, and when I say, and that was interesting, when I did my different case studies, which represented every one of the age brackets that we're in right now, every one of them, every one of those people, what pushed them into burnout was this feeling that I have to keep going, whatever were the voices they were listening to. But then what we also discovered is that the organizational construct encouraged that. So as an organization, and this is interesting, I was just speaking, I won't say the name of the organization, but on Wednesdays, they close down, and by the way, they're global. So whatever is 2 o'clock in the afternoon in that specific area, the offices are closed. The reason the offices are closed, because they want to force people to stop working. Because once we're home, and you were right, you said it when we started out, people are working from home. We're working longer than we ever thought we worked. Because we don't see somebody down the hall. We don't say, hey, let's go have a coffee. Let's sit and have some lunch and let's chit chat. Let's go to happy hour after work. Whatever it is, we don't have these breaks It's constant, constant, constant. So for organizations, how can you craft? And you can. And sometimes it's even a mandate. You may not answer your cell phone for any type of business after 5 o'clock. Nope, can't do it. Nothing on the weekend, forbidden. We also need to actually ask our employees, if I'm in an organization, and this is a really good question, which also can be intelligent optimism. What is the work that you feel that you're being asked to do right now that you wonder, why am I doing this? Does this add value at the end of the day? It's amazing the number of things that we do that don't add value. It's part of this way we've always done stuff. So now that we can back up, we can say organizationally, maybe we don't need to do this. Maybe there's a better way to handle this. Why does it have to be done now? Does it really? Oh, and how about email diarrhea or Zoom meeting diarrhea? You know, it just keeps on and on and on. So stop. So there's two things. It's like a DNA molecule, you know, where it intertwines. So I have the personal and the professional, the personal and the professional. Both sides have an opportunity to take the responsibility to say, stop. And that's going to take some courage on the part of the professional as well as on the personal. And for managers, how willing are you to allow people to share their thoughts?
Exactly. You also talk about role of resilience, and you have a new way of talking about resilience. You also say, like, it's okay when we experience the compression of the stress then, or an event that knocks us down, we're forever changed. So it's not the matter of, okay, we're going to go back to what it was, because we'll never be the same person. And you define resiliency in growing through challenge or opportunity, so you end up wiser, stronger. And that is when breakout happens, actually, coming out of whatever hardship you went through. And you share, like you said, stop first, look next, and then listen deeply to who you are and your body. Can you share a little bit about what you experience in resilience and how to go through? For example, you did that a little bit at the beginning with me. Stop, check your body. Check what, you know, what it is that you're useful for, and what is it, and how does the resilience show up in this process?
Okay. So first off, I want to acknowledge that you read my book. This sounds crazy, but I can't tell you the number of people that interview me, and all they've seen is the cover. So thank you very much for reading that. I appreciate that. That says you are a very good interviewer and you care about your viewers and your listeners. So thank you. So when I define resilience as growing through challenge or opportunity so that you end up wiser, better, smarter, in a different place, what ultimately resilience is energy management. Do I have the mental, emotional, physical capacity to keep on keeping on? And if you think about it, since the definition of burnout is this sphere of exhaustion with all the different arms that go around it. So what is it that's going to give me energy? What is it that's going to deplete the energy? And if you think about energy, when we were kids, we learned that energy is the capacity to do work. So if you think about a power grid, so I've got energy over here and it's going to go across this line. And if the connection is good, the energy moves, and what do you know, the light goes on in my house. If I start my car and it's a good connection from the battery, bingo, car moves forward. Bad connection, the battery is drained, the car goes nowhere. So when we think about moving from burnout to breakthrough, the part we have to step back and say, what gives me energy? What depletes my energy? And where is it that I am, important word, where is it that I am choosing to participate in that energy depletion? And how, in fact, can I recharge that energy? So there are people who deplete our energy. Yeah, I see the look on your face. Yep, you're with it, but you just go, oh my God, this is exhausting to be with this person. There's activity. Now, Not to say that we can't have to, woohoo, I get to do this. Sure, there's things that are challenging, but at some point in time, we have to say, how do I get my energy back? And when do I say, again, time out, stop, cease, desist, because my energy is taken out. And it's not just even physical energy, it's the mental energy.
Yeah, you talk about the area of work, you talk about the area of relationship, and then your soul stuff, you know, like things that happen. And that is so true of how much in our own head we have arguments, we have conversations that suck our energy. Irrelevant at that moment. You know, we have a conversation with someone and then, you know, we carry it for 3 other hours and probably 3 days of being pissed at them and proving right with them and all of that. And it's just like, okay, that's exhausting. That really sucks your energy. So you're looking at how do we stop and look and choose in different areas of our life, in different relationships that we have, including the relationship with ourselves, in how to save energy and kind of discard the areas that are sucking it out of us and put the attention to the ones that are fruitful, let's say.
Mm-hmm. That renews the energy. And, you know, it's just like anything. Are you a dancer? Do you like to dance?
Yes.
I knew it. What's your favorite kind of dance?
Just the free floating and the Persian dance.
Oh, look at you, look at your hands.
Movement and body movement and all of it.
Are you a belly dancer?
No, that is hard. I haven't done
that. That is hard. I tried it once. I couldn't do it. The reason I ask you about that, it's one thing to be engaged in a dance that you love, you know, that keeps you moving. And if somebody said, now we're going to do the foxtrot, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, I can do it, but it doesn't give me the energy that doing all the free flowing gives to me. Well, that's the same thing for different parts of our life. So what is it that will give us this energy? And you said something very important. You said we keep this stuff in our head, and 300 hours later, we're still saying, why didn't I say that? How come I can't do? So what we do is we relive this negative situation. In the meantime, probably the person who we were involved with, they've gone off and they're just happy fine. Now me, I'm sitting here reliving all this stuff. Or I'm saying, again, I have to work this way. So I truly believe in the power of writing. Yes, I am a writer. I am a wordsmith. But when we can take stuff out of our head and look at it in black and white, go, oh my goodness. So here's one of my recommendations. When you find yourself going on and on and on and on and on, and I have to do this, just say, what am I saying to myself? Hello, what am I saying to myself? Okay, Eileen, you need to do this. Blah, blah, blah. And then I say, okay, Eileen, why is this really true? How do you know this is true? What happens when you keep following this? Because now I've taken it out of my head. I actually have almost become my own therapist by looking at, wow, I don't think I need to do this anymore.
Yes.
So that, I have a colleague, Sam Horn, she's brilliant. And she has a line, is you ink it to think it, which is brilliant. So you ink it to think it. I don't care whether it's a notebook, you know, whatever it is, but pull it out of your head so you can look at it and reflect over it.
Definitely.
It's amazing what you will find, because when you step back, you realize that in order to break through, you got to break out of that pattern, that response, that activity.
And you also then talk about, there's, you know, your book is in 3 sections, and the 3rd section is breakthrough. I love the sentence, get your head from baloney to brilliance, like get out of the baloney stuff. But you also talk about practicing reverse goal setting. And I really want you to share that with us, with the intelligence, the gift of intelligence, optimism. Talk a little bit about the reverse goal setting for ourselves in this, you know, perspective of breakthrough.
Well, sometimes we don't know what we want, but what we really understand is what I don't want. So when I went through my first burnout, if you will, which was like 1984, and I quit my job, I had no clue what I was going to do. I just knew that I could not stay in this position anymore. I despised the organization. I was one of the most dysfunctional. I learned a lot about management, about what not to do by being in that organization. But I kept giving out and there was nothing coming back. And so the first thing I did was to write what I did not want. And so when you begin to write what you don't want, what is important to you becomes clearer. You don't want to work this. I don't want this. I don't want this. So reverse goal setting can be pretty powerful, particularly when we feel like we're stuck. We all know what we don't want. Write that. Look at that.
As you're saying that, I'm thinking. I'm looking at what I don't want.
Good. This is good.
What is it that I don't want? It's interesting that one of the conflicts that gets created for me, and I'm sure many people who are with us, it's this diet, because sometimes the excuse, let's say, sometimes the excuse is, well, I can't. There has to be a financial system that moves forward. So there's an anxiety that shows up. Well, I can't let go, or I can't, you know, if I just let go of this, my whole business will come down. So I've got to have the system going just like that. There's no way of handling that. I don't even know how to handle that. Or there's it's not anxiety driven and it's more pleasure driven. Like, ooh, I'm excited about this and I just want to do more, more, more. Or it's altruistic driven in a sense of, you know, I just want to get more people involved in that. So there's also this other part of us which drives that type of movement where then we're not necessarily stopping to look. And every time we stop to look, then that part shows up again and says, but you can't stop. It's because you're feeding this thing, whether it's the anxiety or any of that. Can you share a little bit about that?
Well, let's start. The first thing you talked about was financial. Mm-hmm. You said you want to support this. So I think particularly this is true for those of us particularly who live in the United States. There are some of us that are driven. We think I have to do this because I need all of this stuff. Begin to step back and say, what is it that I truly need? Not want. What do I need? There's a difference between want, need, and have. So have is what I'm supporting right now, whether it's my rent, whether it's, you know, putting gas in the car. You know, what is it that I have? And I really, this is an important thing for me to move forward. What is it that I need, really need, versus what is it that I want? And I will guarantee you, oftentimes we feel that we're on that treadmill because we're feeding the want monster, not the need monster. Mm-hmm. And I discovered this a number of years ago. I took myself away on a private retreat, and it's a wonderful old house in Santa Barbara, and it's got six amazing bedrooms with old, you know, old world furniture and massive bathrooms and stuff. And it's just like stepping back in time. Well, they didn't have room for me. What they gave me was a sleeping porch. And when I say a porch, it might have been, I don't know, 9 by 9. It was just a porch on the second floor. There was a twin bed. And actually, I think it was even smaller than a twin bed. There was a desk. There was a rocking chair, and I'm not even sure there was a bureau dresser. The bathroom, you had to walk out your door, and it was at the end of the hall. And as I laid there, I thought, you know what? I'm really content with this. What I needed were the windows on either side so that I could look out and see the mountains. So I could have the night noises coming in, and needed this bed. I needed a place to put my reading material, but I really didn't need anything else. Oh, and bathroom's essential. But it so struck me that I have very little needs. And when you realize that, there's some freedom in that. So the same thing is true in relationships. Who are the people that fill our hearts versus those who deplete our hearts? And so sometimes, you know, I realize in this isolated COVID-19 world, I have the most precious husband on the planet. We've been married for 40 years. It is the second marriage for both of us. He is significantly older than I am. You'd never know it to look at him. He's as healthy as can be. But when I think about what are options that I might have, my number one priority is him. I'm not going to do anything that jeopardizes him, because that's what I need and I want. So what I say yes to and what I say no to are also driven by keeping him safe. And that fills my heart.
Brought me back to what you said again about looking at it, setting goals the other way around, backwards. It's what I'm hearing is creating a priority list of what you said you don't want, and then look at what is the most important and meaningful for you. And then look at those meaningful concepts. I was thinking, as I was reading your book also, I was thinking about, you know, I'm 59. I probably have 10 more years that I can do that. And it's more like, okay. And then what you say, like my husband is 66. And it's like, how many years more do we have that we could spend time together? And you know, obviously, you know, having the ability to move and do things and be contributory to our family and the world. And is looking at that, it's like, okay, you know, I've done this for the past 60 years of my life. What is it that I want to do in the next 10 years or 20 years of my life? And then kind of like look at that perspective of this is a time frame, like this countdown. And then in this, what is it that is the most important where I can actually focus on? And then, you know, build that part and then pay attention to that and then kind of like declutter the rest of the stuff in a sense. Eileen McDar, everyone, in 1 minute, is there anything we haven't touched and you really want everybody to know?
Oh, wow. 1 minute. Okay, so what can I say in 1 minute that is meaningful? First off, claim your life. Nobody else can. So when you claim your life, at the end of your life, what do you want people to have said? And I guarantee you, it's not how much money you made. It's not the kind of house you lived in. It was, what was it that filled the reason why you're here? There's two things. The great joy in life is when you're born. The better joy is when you find out why. And all of us have a why. So when I pay attention to the why, I can handle almost just about anything as long as I'm focused on that.
Beautiful. So please get the book, Burnout to Breakthrough, Building Resilience to Refuel, Recharge, and Reclaim What Matters. And you can go to eileenmcdarg.com, is eileenmcdarg.com. Thank you so much, Eileen, for being with us at the show. It was beautiful to read your book and to have a chat with you.
Thank you so much. My great pleasure.
And for everyone, create an amazing world for yourself and everyone around you.